verses. Many of the lyrics had been changed to remove curses. The group began playing shows on the road, piling into Easy's navy blue Ford Aerostar minivan and sharing cheap motel rooms. At first, they opened up for Alonzo's revamped version of World Class Wrecking Crew, which was awkward for everyone considering their disparate styles and the fact that Dre and Yella had quit the group. But by 1988, had graduated to performing with acts like Salt and Pepper, MC Hammer, Heavy D, and UTFO. They got strange looks for their jerry curl. "Who the fuck is y'all niggas?" they were asked. When Cube returned from Arizona later in 1988, for good, Ren stayed in the group. Hail Mary. Despite NWA's traction on the road, Jerry Heller was striking out with his industry contacts. By late 1987, the group still hadn't landed a record deal. Really, it wasn't too hard to figure out. Black performers like Michael Jackson and Prince may have ruled the pop charts. They were expected to look, talk, and act decent. Innuendo was okay, but NWA was too violent, too real. Rap had gone mainstream less than a decade earlier, and many labels still thought it was a fad. The board chairman of Capitol Records told Heller that NWA would never sell. David Geffen expressed concern over how NWA was talking about gays. Never mind that Geffen Records' white-hot metal band, Guns N' Roses, would soon employ gay and racial slurs themselves on their 1988 track, One in a Million. Eventually, Heller threw something of a Hail Mary pass, taking a meeting in August 1988 with Brian Turner and Mark Cerami of Priority Records. Though they had great distribution, Priority wasn't exactly a major industry force. Their biggest claim to fame was the California Raisins, claymation dried grapes dreamed up by the state's Raisin Marketing Commission. Singing Motown classics and other nostalgic hits, they were voiced by Buddy Miles, a former Jimi Hendrix collaborator. The act's shifting image was alternately as soul group, trendy b-boys, and quartet of straining turds. The Raisins eventually sold more than 3 million copies. It wasn't as much of a fluke as it sounds. Turner and Cerami were former executives at KTEL Records, repackaging old hits into genre collections advertised on late-night television, Hooked on Swing, Funky Super Hits. Heller trusted Priority's ability to market music outside of radio, which was mostly a non-starter for NWA due to their cussing. And so soon he and the crew met the Priority Brain Trust in a cigarette-smoke-filled Hollywood conference room. Easy, his pagers buzzing in his jean pockets, put his Air Jordans up onto the table, while Ren mean-mugged. Eventually, Dre arrived with a cassette and played Gangsta Gangsta, the group's latest track, and perhaps their tightest and most on-message yet. It kicks off with a drive-by shooting, and soon police sirens wail. "Drinking straight out of the eight bottle," raps Ice Cube over a mid-tempo beat and funk guitar riff appropriated from Steve Arrington. "Do I look like a motherfucking role model to a kid looking up to me? Life ain't nothing but bitches and money." Turner, a Canadian, didn't immediately get it. "I couldn't believe the things they talked about actually happened," he said later. But he became fully convinced after seeing the group perform at a Reseda roller rink. The crowd sung along in unison to Fuck the Police, a controversial, officially unreleased anthem that was being given out for free by NWA's street teams, comprised of kids spreading out across the city to promote the group. Priority agreed to finance and distribute both Eazy-E's solo album and NWA's official debut, under the imprint of Ruthless Records. It was the best of both worlds, major label clout with effective indie distribution, wrote Heller. They had marketing people. They had a full staff. They could get records in all the stores. It was almost like a West Coast version of Def Jam, said Warehouse Records' Violet Brown. Once Priority got their hands on it, it exploded. Chapter 6. A little bit of gold, and a pager. You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge. Dr. Dre kicked off N.W.A.'s landmark 1988 debut album, Straight Outta Compton, with this cocksure mission statement, promising to present in vivid detail the culmination of a youth marked by survival tactics and institutional humiliations. Dre, Easy, Cube, Ren, DJ Yella, and Arabian Prince were the ultimate anti-heroes, rock stars prepping America for the post-Reagan era, when good and evil would no longer be so white and black. It's a dope line, and prescient, too. We did witness it, and we were never the same. The album's most memorable songs feature an assault of abrasive textures, marching drums, samples fragments, and breakbeats mined from Rhodium Swap Meet Records. Straight Outta Compton's bombastic sound matches its rhetoric. To hear it as a child of poverty was to nod in affirmation. To hear it as person of privilege was to gasp in horror. MC Ren has called tracks 3 through 13 filler. I don't agree. But the work's greatest power lies in its opening tracks. Straight Outta Compton and Fuck the Police. Blurring the line between rapper and character, the self-referential protagonists are badasses bearing heavy artillery who recognize corruption and are fighting back. What's most shocking, however, is that they're not so much political soldiers as nihilist murderous criminals. America wasn't ready, but it had no choice but to adapt, and the work's charged rhetoric is so ferociously eloquent that it still resonates today. Police think they have the authority to kill a minority, Ice Cube raps on Fuck the Police, adding, fucking with me 'cause I'm a teenager, with a little bit of gold and a pager, searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. The time for reasoned debate has passed, and he has lost his cool. But Cube's enemies extend beyond just the cops. Anyone who crosses him is fair game for his wrath, as he raps on Straight Outta Compton. Crazy motherfucker named Ice Cube, from the gang called Niggas with Attitudes. When I'm called off, I got a sawed off, squeeze the trigger and bodies are hauled off. So what if his benefactor Eazy-E actually was guilty of selling drugs? So what if Ice Cube had denounced gangs and wasn't, in real life, the madman he portrayed? The anger and pent-up frustrations he vocalized on behalf of his compatriots was real. Shouting out Compton wasn't a popular thing to do at the time, but N.W.A. was following in the tradition of other rap acts who were proud of where they were from, like Boogie Down Productions, who paid homage to the South Bronx, and Run DMC from Hollis, Queens. I think we was all thinking about making a name for Compton in L.A., said MC Ren. Cube, of course, wasn't from Compton, which made the whole thing a little weird. But it just felt silly yelling South Central when everyone else was yelling Compton, he said. And Compton and South Central is two sides of the same coin, so to speak. Straight Outta Compton owes its greatest debt to Long Island group Public Enemy, whose own landmark work, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, came out less than 2 months earlier, captivating rap fans and hip, politically conscious rock fans alike, with a message of black unity and urging revolt against the power structure. Public Enemy made revolutionary stylings all the rage and helped usher in hip-hop's golden era of the late 80s and early 90s, which also included acts like A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul. It was a time of Afrocentric positivity and uplifting rhymes before macho posturing consumed the genre. N.W.A. was simultaneously a part of and removed from this golden era movement. More a declaration of anarchy than a disciplined treatise, Straight Outta Compton offered little of Public Enemy's tempered positivity. Ice Cube felt an acute sense of responsibility, but Dr. Dre called the idea that the group was political nonsense. The black police in Compton are worse than the white police, Eazy-E said.
Chuck D gets involved in all that black stuff. We don't. Fuck that black power shit. We don't give a fuck. Free South Africa. We don't give a fuck. I bet there ain't anybody in South Africa wearing a button saying Free Compton or Free California.
Straight Outta Compton was bold and fresh, but also potentially destructive.
It was the best song of that album, said DJ Yella. It went right to the point. Wasn't no sugarcoating. Nothing. This is where we from. This is how it is. And that was a song that didn't take long to make. A couple of days. That's it.
There was little precedent for such brazen, anarchic polemics told in street language. Cube's angry, arrogant character is on the hunt for anyone who disrespect him. Eazy-E is dangerous, too, but more cunning, and in it for the long con. The combustible persona of MC Ren, meanwhile, is liable to go off at any time. It's a potent trio. Dre wasn't yet doing much rapping. And even more remarkable when you realize that Cube and Ren were only 19 when the album dropped. Born one day apart in June 1969, they were already beginning to peak as performers. They pushed each other during recording sessions. Starting at midnight, they went all night in the studio. Even when finished, they might go back and change their verse if the other made a hotter one. Guilty of Being a Redneck. The album's second track, Fuck the Police, has become the most famous protest song in rap history, and perhaps the greatest in history, period. A protest against law enforcement's abuse of minorities, Fuck the Police has served as an anthem for protest movements ranging from the 1992 LA riots to demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri, over the 2014 killing of an unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown by a white police officer. Hundreds, if not thousands, of rappers have paid homage to it. Ice Cube gets credit for coming up with the song's concept, and he understood how provocative the message would be.
We was sick of being harassed by the police, just because we was young and black. Daryl Gates had declared a war on gangs, Cube said. And if you think every black kid is a gang member, that means there's a war on every black kid you see.
Dre wasn't initially down. He liked the idea of the track, but didn't want to exacerbate a personal situation. Owing to traffic arrests in early 1988, he was serving weekend lockup, only let out during the week to work.
He didn't want that song out while he had to go back and forth in the county, Cube said. But when he got off that little stint, when I brought the idea back up, he was down to do it.
In his book, Jerry Heller wrote that in the fall of 1987, the group members were standing outside Audio Achievement Studio in Torrance when, apropos of nothing, police pulled up and without explanation put the artists on their knees and demanded to see their IDs. A similar scene is portrayed in the Straight Outta Compton film, which then inspires Cube to pen a draft of Fuck the Police. Alonzo Williams suspects a different incident helped shape the song. He recalled hearing about a pre-Fuck the Police joyride taken by Easy, Dre, and others, in which they shot people's cars with paintball guns on the Harbor Freeway. They were pulled over, had guns put to their heads, and handcuffed before police let them go.
They come back to my house shaking like leaves on a tree on a windy day, damn near crying,
Lonzo wrote in his memoir.
Man, fuck the police.
Easy may have been referencing this incident when he gave an account of police harassment, telling a television interviewer he was once
snatched out of my car, gun to my head on the freeway, laid down.
Dre fleshed out the structure of Fuck the Police, including a courtroom skit in which an officer is put on trial. As judge, Dre announces his verdict.
The jury has found you guilty of being a redneck, white bread, chicken shit motherfucker.
The convicted policeman, played by DOC, yells as he's being dragged out in his widest voice,
Fuck you, you black motherfucker!
Reality Rap. NWA's members were a bunch of wallflowers. Dr. Dre, by his own admission, suffers from social anxiety, while Eazy-E could go through entire meetings without saying anything. MC Ren was quiet. Arabian Prince wasn't in the mix for long. And DJ Yella could be in a room and you'd never know he was there, wrote Alonzo Williams. Cube was the only one you wouldn't call an introvert. But together, the group's music was even more aggressive than Schoolie D or Ice-T. The mindset of those guys had changed so much, to the point that I didn't know them anymore, added Lonzo, convinced that this new style would get people to pay attention. The group inflated gangster rap into a full-blown hip-hop subgenre in one fell swoop with Straight Outta Compton. Nobody at the time used the term gangster rap, however. They preferred reality rap. We're telling the real story of what it's like living in places like Compton. We're giving them reality. We're like reporters. We give them the truth. People where we come from hear so many lies that the truth stands out like a sore thumb, Easy said. This was not the airbrushed, optimistic Black America of The Cosby Show or DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, whose Parents Just Don't Understand was a hit that year. What Jazzy Jeff and rappers like him talk about is phony stuff, added MC Ren. They're talking about what the white world and the white kids can identify with. If you're a Black kid from the streets and somebody is rapping about parents not understanding, you'd laugh at that. You might not have parents, or you'd have parents that were into crack or prostitution. Easy maintained that making money was the ultimate goal. The music business is what pulled Easy from the dope game, not politics or like Cube and Dre, because he was blessed with obvious musical gifts. What Easy lacked in natural rapping abilities, he made up for with vision and marketing savvy. He saw a radio dial crammed with wussy, ineffectual performers and sought to fill the void. He made no bones about his desire to shock and awe. In 1993, Dr. Dre famously disparaged Straight Outta Compton. To this day, I can't stand that album. I threw that thing together in 6 weeks so we could have something to sell out of the trunk. In a more recent interview, he said, back then, I thought the choruses were supposed to just be me scratching. This is harsh self-criticism from a perfectionist. A more accurate quote might be, I threw that thing together at an obscure studio on a budget of less than $10,000, and it became one of hip-hop's greatest albums. Indeed, N.W.A. quickly conceived and recorded the work at the Out of the Way Audio Achievement Studio in Torrance. Dre and Yella led the album's production, assisted by Arabian Prince and owner-engineer Donovan Smith, and they borrowed both from Public Enemy's Sonic Pastiche approach and their bombast. The Long Island group's 1987 debut, Yo Bum Rushed the Show, and its follow-up, It Takes a Nation of Millions, employed the dizzying chop sample production of the Bomb Squad, an affiliated production team who brought a new level of complexity to hip-hop beats. But Dre also used live instruments to recreate parts of other folks' records he liked, employing, say, a guitar or a flute player to make it sound like a sample. Live instrumentation meant Dre could control the instrument's individual levels. If you have a sample, you can't bring the bass guitar up or the guitar up without turning the whole sample up, explained session guitarist and bass guitarist Stan the Guitar Man Jones. Dre's perfectly tuned ear, Monk's patience, and effective bedside manner fused together 1,000 disparate ideas. Easy may have been writing the checks for the studio sessions, but throughout the recording of Straight Outta Compton, everybody knew Dre was the boss. Dre was like the main ear, said MC Ren. He'd tell you, try to make it like this. You do it, he'd be like, cool, or that's terrible. Some tracks are more original than others. The beat from Express Yourself is a near copy of Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Rhythm Band's 1970 hit of the same name, which Wright was appalled to discover upon the record's release. Priority Record put him in touch with Ice Cube, who apologized profusely, and I got my royalties, Wright said. The song features a then-rare example of Dre rapping quickly, and he proves himself a nimble lyricist.
though his anti-drug message would prove embarrassing to him later. "I don't smoke weed or cess, 'cause it's known to give a brother brain damage." Jones said he and Laylaw would smoke weed in the studio and invite Dre to participate, but he always turned them down with a laugh. Like, "I don't need that shit." Straight Outta Compton is a direct product of Eazy-E's vision. MC Ren made it raw, while Cube gave it its caustic political edge, the thing for which it's most remembered. Of course, none of this would have mattered if Dre hadn't finally molded its structure. As for Yella's contribution to Straight Outta Compton, on the album he receives a co-producing credit, along with Dre. "I'd be on the board and he'd be on the drum machine," Yella said. "So I'd go over there and program all the stuff on the machine. We were just like a team. We didn't have to be like, I do this and you do that. It was like Batman and Robin." "Yella was good at the technical part," said Dre. According to Ren, Dre did the heavy lifting, and Yella was more like Dre's assistant, which is a word others used as well. "He didn't really come up with concepts, but he did the tedious shit and allowed Dre to concentrate on helping everyone else," DOC said. Yella would be doing editing as far as splicing different parts of songs together once they were recorded on the two-track, said Stan Jones, adding that Dre came up with all the beats. Straight Outta Compton still sounds fresh today, with the exception of its final track, Something to Dance To, a throwback to the L.A. electro scene. I like it, and it was a dance floor hit at the time, but it's remembered now as electro's swan song, considering that N.W.A. pretty much obliterated the sound. Cribbing from Sly and the Family Stone, it features up-tempo disco grooves, jittery synths, and suggestions to feel the groove, bust a move. Though Dre and Yella are credited as the track's producers, and Eazy and Dre as its writers, its textures feel like the handiwork of Arabian Prince, who said he was not properly given credit for that song and others on the album, and that such shenanigans helped fuel his decision to leave the group. Some have speculated that Arabian Prince was unwilling or unable to make the transition from electro to hardcore rap, but he told me the real reason he left N.W.A., because he found Jerry Heller's financial dealings disreputable. "We were selling all these records and weren't seeing the money we were supposed to be seeing," he said, adding that unlike the other group members, he was already financially stable owing to his successful DJ career. Though he left the group in 1988, while Straight Outta Compton was still being recorded, he contributed a great deal of production work on the album and on its cover. He has been unfairly glossed over by history, not to mention whitewashed out of the Straight Outta Compton film. It's not clear to me why N.W.A.'s classic lineup is considered to be Eazy, Dre, Cube, Ren, and Yella, since those five alone never actually made an album together. You think white kids would like this? Today, Straight Outta Compton is remembered as a game-changing, seismic work that altered not just the hip-hop landscape, but popular music at large. It didn't make much noise upon its release, however. Rolling Stone didn't review it, or even write a major story on the band until their second album. Many critics just didn't get it. Somehow DJs Dr. Dre and Yella drive the three MCs past their own lies half the time, wrote critic Robert Christgau. Radio play was scant, especially at first, but it had great distribution and was steadily propelled by word of mouth. The more hardcore the rap group was, the more the white kids wanted it, said Warehouse Records' Violet Brown. All the areas people thought were lily white, like Utah, were actually areas I sold a lot of albums. In their hometown, N.W.A. autograph sessions drew hundreds and then thousands of fans. A show following their debut's release at Skateland hit capacity with some 2,200 attendees, including hordes of screaming groupies and limos that whisked them to an after-party at the Bonaventure Hotel. Skateland's Craig Schweisinger said the show was so loud that his ears rang for days. But there were hiccups.
They were turned away from their own album party at a Beverly Center club because, reportedly, the doorman thought they were a bunch of thugs. Around the time of Easy Does It's release, while performing at Harlem's Apollo Theater, the unimpressed, fickle audience booed them and threw things at them. At the Anaheim Celebrity Theater, a brawl broke out on stage and the cops had to intervene. Attendees reported stabbings. Straight Outta Compton entered a gathering media storm that had already placed Los Angeles at the center of America's crime epidemic, on the front lines of both the gang and crack cocaine explosions. Earlier in 1988, the Dennis Hopper-directed hit film Colors focused on a pair of crash unit cops played by Robert Duvall and Sean Penn in the middle of an L.A. gang war. 70,000 gang members, 1 million guns, 2 cops, was the tagline. Ice-T performed the theme song, which he credits for really launching his career. Critics at the time lauded the film's supposed realism, but I cringed at the depiction of the black and Latino characters during a recent viewing. The volunteer crime patrol group, the Guardian Angels, meanwhile, felt it glorified criminal street life. Accusing Sean Penn of profiting from gang violence, they left an Oscar award in the form of a toilet bowl outside of his Malibu house. Leaving aside the question of whether music may cause kids to behave violently, N.W.A. undoubtedly affected teenagers everywhere. I was 11 years old when Straight Outta Compton was released, and my own group of friends was obsessed with the group and its members as we entered Central High School in St. Paul, Minnesota, a few years later. More so than St. Paul as a whole, the school was racially diverse, with white kids like myself bussed in from out of the neighborhood for the International Baccalaureate program. I initially disliked N.W.A. Raised on the police are infallible message of Dragnet reruns, fuck the police seemed not just wrong to me at first, but gimmicky and insincere. But, as outlaw art often does, it eventually swayed my friends and me. We began to question not just authority, but whether drug dealers and gangbangers were inherently bad people, as we'd been coached. We took from N.W.A.'s music both the righteous politics and the bombast, but mostly the bombast, mocking cops under our breath, mimicking Eazy-E's sleazy come-ons, pulling our athletic shorts down low, and getting drunk on Old English. Some of us wore pagers or bought oversized car speakers with maximum bass. We could only dream of driving 6.4s, though I, for one, didn't know until later that this referred to a 1964 Impala. We even threw up signs for our neighborhood gangs, named for our local recreation center, and called the Lankford Park Posse. The signs required making L's with both hands, and then twisting the left one 90 degrees clockwise to form a P with the other. Despite the fact that most of us couldn't place Compton on a map, we imagined the city to be both terrifying and the epicenter of cool. To share these memories now is deeply embarrassing, and I realize how insensitive and ridiculous our teenage actions may sound, attempting to appropriate the cool of people whose lives and backgrounds we could hardly fathom. But it's important for me to impart a sense of just how normal this behavior was in white America at the time. If you'll excuse the terrible term, we weren't wiggers. Just about everyone we knew imitated L.A. gangbangers. The guys, at least, and plenty of the girls, too. It was a sense of being a badass, of empowering myself to be bigger and tougher than I would normally see myself, my friend Eric Royce Peterson told me of gangster rap's appeal. As it turns out, the white suburban audience that flocked to N.W.A. wasn't just a fluke. Dr. Dre was hoping for a reaction like this. One white ruthless employee who asked that his name not be used said Dre would sometimes invite him to his Nissan Pathfinder to play him the group's latest work. "You think white kids would like this?" he'd ask. In Los Angeles in 1991, Married with Children star David Faustino, who played Christina Applegate's randy younger brother Bud Bundy, together with a group including Nick Adler, scion of Sunset Strip icon Lou Adler, began putting on a premier hip-hop party called Ballistics, which drew a multiracial teenage crowd and was frequented by Eazy-E, who would pull up in front in his BMW parking in the red zone. Never mind the tickets. Exhibit and Will.i.am would freestyle battle, and another future Black Eyed Peas member, Fergie, danced in a cage. Despite being a wealthy white kid, Faustino had hip-hop credibility largely because his TV character showed genuine love for the genre, even putting up Ice Cube and Nas posters in his bedroom.
"My album poster being on Bud's wall was one of the illest moments for me," Nas said. "My whole projects went crazy. It was a sign that I made it in a lot of ways."
Another sign was fashion. Straight Outta Compton's success didn't just vanquish the reigning L.A. hip-hop style. It vanquished the reigning L.A. hip-hop wardrobe as well. Eazy-E almost single-handedly ushered out the East Coast aesthetic. So long, dookie ropes and giant glasses. Borrowing from the local gang aesthetic, he wore white t-shirts, brand new and often more than one at a time, Dickies, khakis, and black ball caps. One of his favorites said, "Compton," and he got it custom made at a Compton swap meet store run by a North Korean immigrant named Won Joon Kim, which was also one of the first to sell gangster rap. The black and silver colors were appropriated by N.W.A. from the Raiders, who played in Los Angeles from 1982 to 1994. This became the gear of choice for street cats and wannabe street cats the country over.
"We go to the Foot Locker in KC, and it would be Chief shit all on the rack, and all the Raiders gear would be gone," Ice Cube said.
Chapter 7. All Hell Breaks Loose. Just a month after Straight Outta Compton hit stores, Eazy-E released his own album, Easy Does It. Because of the success of The Boys in the Hood, Eazy-E, solo artist, was at this point more famous than N.W.A., and the album strikes a different tone than Compton, lighter and more coarse at the same time, less Public Enemy and more Dolemite. Though it features Dr. Dre beats and the whole N.W.A. cast of characters, it largely eschews Compton's pent-up aggression and bombast for tall tales from the bedroom, humorous kiss-and-tell anecdotes, and testaments to Easy's toughness. There are plenty of threats. "If you press your luck, I'll smoke you like that and won't give a fuck." But the character most comes to life when hyperbolically discussing his own virility. Opener, Still Talking Shit, features a peanut gallery of old-timers assessing Easy's performance.
"I told you that nigga was crazy,"
as he brags about how well-endowed he is.
"At least a yard."
How many women it takes to satisfy him.
"At least three."
And what he does with vaginas he doesn't have time for.
"Puts them in the freezer."
"Hey, Easy," asks a female crowd member on We Want Easy, "why you wear your pants like that?"
"I wear my pants like this for easy access, baby."
On the album, Easy's raunchy jokes sometimes give way to something darker, a glorification of violence against women.
"I might be a woman beater, but I'm not a pussy eater," he raps on Still Talking.
In the bank heist tale, Nobody Move, his character attempts to rape a woman, only to discover that she is a he, at which point he sticks a gun up the man's skirt.
"Because this is one faggot that I had to hurt."
When the Los Angeles Times called him on his misogyny in a 1989 interview, Easy claimed to be simply speaking the language of the streets on the album.
"We're not putting down women," he said. "It's just street talk. Women understand that. They like us. They buy our records. They don't think of us as bad guys. We're not disrespecting women. We're disrespecting bitches," he added to spin, prompting the question,
"What's the difference between a bitch and a woman?"
"A woman is a woman. A bitch is someone who carries herself in a stuck-up way. A bitch is someone who fucks everybody except me."
Like Andre Young, Eric Wright hurt women in real life. His girlfriend, Tracy Jernigan, told me he once shot her with a BB gun, similar to the time she smashed up his BMW after finding him with another woman. She again came to his house and suspected him of cheating, she said. He told her to leave, and she was returning to her car when he came outside, armed, she said, adding that she believed he was just trying to scare her when he pulled the trigger. But the pellet hit her in the head, and she went to the emergency room. Wright didn't accompany her to the hospital. A doctor was forced to cut the pellet out, she said. NWA affiliate DJ Speed corroborated the rough outlines of her story. Lisa Johnson, the mother of three of Dr. Dre's children, who says Dre beat her, also accused Easy of beating her. She told me that while she was seeing Dre in the mid-80s, a friend of hers was dating Easy. The four of them were planning to go to Magic Mountain one day, Johnson said, when the two women happened to drive by in a car in Compton, inhabited by Easy and the mother of one of his children. Johnson's friend was not happy to see Easy with another woman, and she hopped out of the car. Easy's two love interests began arguing, and all hell broke loose, Johnson said. Though she said the whole thing was merely a chance encounter, Easy seemed to believe Johnson brought her friend to the scene to start shit, she said. He came over to the car where I was and started fighting me and punching me in my nose, Johnson said, adding that her injuries were so bad that she ended up at a Culver City hospital. Johnson's aunt, who asked her name not to be used, said she arrived to the hospital to find her niece's face swollen. She was at my house for weeks. Could barely walk. In a 1993 Howard Stern interview, Easy himself discussed beating a woman. Kicked her ass for doing scandalous things. America gets foot loose. These incidents weren't publicly known at the time of NWA and Eazy-E's rise, but their lyrics nonetheless put them in the cultural crosshairs. Not long after the start of Reagan's second term in 1985, the major record labels agreed to self-apply parental warning stickers on their albums, as advised by Tipper Gore's Parents Music Resource Center, a committee organized to save the children from naughty music. Straight Outta Compton had the sticker, and its second song was printed as Blank the Police. At this point, the country got all footloose. Pop artists across the spectrum were jailed for indecent performances, including Skid Row's Sebastian Bach, Bobby Brown, and LL Cool J. An Arkansas sheriff pulled heavy metal and hip-hop tapes from a Walmart. Guar was told not to swear in concert. Dead Kennedy's frontman, Jello Biafra, had his home raided by the LAPD and was charged with obscenity for a graphic poster included in his band's album, Frankenchrist. The charges were later dismissed. In 1989, Gore and her Parents' Music Resource Center colleague, Susan Baker, Treasury Secretary James Baker's wife, equated rap with rape in a piece for Newsweek. Discussing the phenomenon of wilding, they noted that the teenaged accused rapists of a Central Park jogger could later be heard in lockup, singing a high-on-the-charts rap song about casual sex, Wild Thing. Tone Loc's track has nothing to do with rape. Perhaps most notorious was the McCullough-spawned group Two Live Crew, now based in Miami. They came under fire for the sexual nature of their 1989 album, As Nasty As They Wanna Be. A U.S. District Court judge deemed songs like Me So Horny obscene, leading to arrests of both a Fort Lauderdale store owner and the group itself, following a performance. They were later vindicated by the Supreme Court, and the album sold briskly. Plenty of people balked at NWA, from squeamish mothers confiscating their kids' tapes to the police who refused to work NWA concerts. But many liberals were similarly aghast at the group's non-politically correct themes and imagery, conquering and degrading women, crushing adversaries. There is an element of documentary realism about NWA's music, wrote Frank Owen of Spin in 1990, but that is largely overshadowed by the gleeful delight the band takes in demonstrating their supposed toughness. In reality, NWA have more in common with a Charles Bronson movie than a PBS documentary on the plight of the inner cities. In the world NWA's records described, all men were amoral brutes and self-loathing thugs who reveled in getting drunk and murdering one another, wrote journalist John Mendelson. Had virulent white supremacists ghostwritten their stuff for them, who would have been able to tell the difference? Mainstream radio wasn't happening, and even college radio stations weren't sure what to think. A few Bay Area stations banned the group. University of California Berkeley's KALX and San Francisco community station KPOO had been early NWA advocates, even hosting them in studio. But the DJs for their hip-hop shows, along with those from Stanford University's KZSU, later struck the group's songs from their playlists, owing to the act's negative lyrics and influence over youth. In an April 1989 interview with Ice Cube, KALX DJ Davey D challenged NWA's frequent self-characterization as reporters, wondering if children would be able to understand this nuance. If you see a movie like Psycho 3, the person in the movie might be psycho, but kids know what's real and what's not, Ice Cube responded. Just because there's a monster person in a movie who's psycho and killing people, that don't mean they're gonna go psycho and kill people. Davey D noted that he'd polled listeners about whether or not to play the group. And while opinions were mixed overall, we had younger people calling up and saying, hey, we live in San Francisco, and there are Crips up here now, and they don't like it. They say it's our fault that there are Crips up there now, Ice Cube said in response. There's been violence since the beginning of time. There ain't no such word as peace. There ain't never gonna be peace. Many major retailers refused to stock the album, and MTV refused to play the Straight Outta Compton video on the grounds that it glorified violence. By the late 80s, the network was influential enough to break acts by putting them in regular rotation. Though they'd long neglected rap, the show Yo MTV Raps, which debuted in 1988, was changing things. But Straight Outta Compton wasn't on it. Does the music video glorify violence? Even with cleaned-up lyrics, it's certainly provocative, with Ice Cube miming pumping a shotgun and the crew antagonizing police. But it feels more documentary than incendiary. Set in various parts of Compton, it reenacts the notorious gang sweeps of the area, and is also pretty funny, with Eazy-E taunting the cops from his convertible. No one shoots at police or anyone else. The MTV ban hit the group hard, as they were betting on the network's huge viewership to propel them. They also publicly complained of hypocrisy. The hair metal craze had men in stretch pants objectifying women just as blatantly. But the station did show NWA's next work, Express Yourself, a hit that pushed boundaries in its own right. Opening with slaves toiling in a field and a child facing a master's whip, it cuts to a shot of the group exploding through a paper banner with the words, I have a dream. In some versions of the video, the message was blurred. The modern version of the child now found himself behind bars as Dre rap lyrics written by Cube. I'm expressing with my full capabilities, and now I'm living in correctional facilities. Way too many police out here. In 1989, the 200,000-member-strong National Fraternal Order of Police voted not to provide service at concerts for acts that threatened police. This was potentially troubling news for NWA, who set out on their own first national tour, hitting dozens of cities that year. A 1989 Village Voice cover story on various attempts to censor NWA maintains that the police union likely learned about Fuck the Police from Reverend James C. Dobson's magazine, focused on the family citizen. An article titled, Rap Group NWA Says Kill Police, asked readers to alert local police to the dangers they may face in the wake of this record release. Christian right readers sprang into action, notifying departments, and police faxed copies of the lyrics to other stations around the country, pushing to cancel shows on NWA's tour. They were successful in cities like Milwaukee and Washington, D.C. Toledo Minister Floyd E. Rose said police were pressuring black clergymen there to speak on their behalf, but he refused, writing to the police chief there, I must say that while I do not like the music and abhor the vulgar language, I will not be used to stifle legitimate anger and understandable resentment. The show went on in Toledo, albeit with no help from police, as it did in dozens of other cities, including Kansas City, where the acting mayor attempted to cancel NWA's concert, telling them, "Take your trash back to L.A." When the show went off as planned, Ice Cube remarked on stage, "We just showed your city council that blacks, whites, Mexicans, and Orientals can get together for a concert without killing each other." In the cities where they were allowed to perform, NWA's stage show was polished and professional. They had backup dancers, if you can imagine that, and Dre would get the crowd hype with warm-up chants like, "Just throw your hands in the air and wave them like you're on welfare." Easy, who acted something like the headliner, wouldn't come on stage until about 20 minutes into the show. Many early shows were billed as Eazy-E and NWA. Despite Cube's pleas, this wasn't exactly a goodwill tour, and behind the scenes, life on the road was chaotic. The group was kicked off their first flight for arguing with a flight attendant. While they showed off fake guns on stage, they traveled from city to city with plentiful real firearms and munitions. Alonzo Williams went along gun shopping beforehand. "These guys are buying automatic and semi-automatic weapons to go on tour with," he said. "I'm like, shit, what kind of tour you guys going on, Vietnam?" Heller made sure that one tour bus had only guns, while another had only bullets. Cube insisted they needed the guns for protection. He claimed that in Detroit, once with Ice-T, local gangsters came calling, and the assault rifles came out. But for all their bravado, they didn't really know how to properly handle guns, said one of the Ruthless's bodyguards, Joe Fierro, with Dre wanting to shoot with his hand cocked sideways, like a gangster. Though Easy had an armory's worth of weapons at his disposal, including rifles with red eyes and night scopes and night vision, he had no expertise beyond street shooting, said Fierro, a Vietnam veteran whose nickname was KJ Mustafa. So on various tour stops, they went to firing ranges, with Fierro showing Easy how to take apart his weapons and properly care for them. Fierro said he would contact local law enforcement to try to smooth things over before they arrived in town, and so the group wouldn't inadvertently wander into hostile gang zones. Despite constant badgering from the media, protesters, local community leaders, and fake-ass Jerry Curl-wearing preachers, in the words of MC Ren, the group refused to remove Gangsta Gangsta and Straight Outta Compton from their playlists. They agreed not to perform Fuck the Police, but things came to a head on the final night of their tour on August 6, 1989, at Joe Louis Arena in downtown Detroit, home of the Red Wings hockey team. The concert was headlined by LL Cool J and featured all-stars including Big Daddy Kane, De La Soul, and Slick Rick. Some 20,000 fans filled the venue. Rather than boycotting the show, the police presence was robust. DJ Speed, who was performing as DOC's turntablist, said he was spooked to see cops lining up alongside the stage. "Way too many police out here," he remembered thinking, adding that they had a command center downstairs. That particular night, all our personnel were working that venue. "There were close to 200 of us. We were strategically placed," confirmed Detroit Police Sergeant Larry Quartz. NWA's camp specifically promised Detroit police beforehand that they wouldn't perform Fuck the Police. But Cube said the group had been besieged that day by fans asking them to perform the song. And so backstage before the show, they had a powwow. "Yo, man, should we do Fuck the Police?" There was no consensus, and Cube assumed the plan was a no-go. But after they performed Gangsta Gangsta, the crowd began chanting, "Fuck the Police!" After A Bitch is a Bitch, the crowd chanted, "Fuck the Police!" again. Same thing after Straight Outta Compton. While Cube was rapping, "I Ain't the One," he noticed Dre and Ren speaking near the turntables. Shortly thereafter, Ren motioned toward him,
Wait a minute, Ren said, moving toward the front of the stage. To the crowd, Ren said,
Everybody say, fuck the police! Fuck the police!
The crowd roared back. Back by the turntables, Dre looked in Cube's direction.
Come in on two.
Dre counted it down, and Cube came on.
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. The place went stupid, Cube said. Then we see about 20 motherfuckers from the back trying to bum rush the front.
They were undercover police, members of the department's gang squad, it turns out, tossing aside chairs. Attempting to shut down the show, they climbed the barricade and began dismantling amplifiers. Suddenly, a pair of pops, which sounded like gunfire. They were actually firecrackers, according to eyewitnesses, although it's unclear if they were set off by police. Cube and Ren ran off stage, with Cube changing his shirt and looking for an exit. The cops made their way backstage, mistakenly pushing their way into LL Cool J's dressing room. Meanwhile, NWA loaded themselves into a van.
Go to the hotel, pack your shit,
the group's road manager Atron Gregory told them.
We're going to Canada.
By some accounts, the group's frenzied departure from Detroit did take them briefly into Canada, but they ended up back at their hotel. The police caught up with them there, and according to Cube, said they'd be going to jail. But all they did was talk to us, he added. They told us they wanted to arrest us on stage to front us off in front of everybody to show that you can't say fuck the police in Detroit. This version of events veers from the Straight Outta Compton biopic, where the group members are arrested outside the arena and thrown in a paddy wagon. In reality, however, 18 concertgoers were arrested outside the venue and charged with misdemeanors. Sergeant Quartz later said the decision to shut down the show was a poor one, considering the chaos it caused. NWA shortly returned home to L.A., but not before Cube made the police an offer they could and did refuse.
Yo, y'all want to do a song called Fuck NWA?
He claims to have said.
We'll produce it.
The Detroit fiasco wasn't the only difficulty the group encountered during that first national tour in 1989. In early June, Curtis Crayon, the father of Dre's half-brother Tyree, and their mother Verna Griffin's ex-husband, suffered a heart attack and died. Tyree took the news hard.
I don't think Tyree ever fully recovered from the shock, wrote Griffin in her memoir.
Though there were some positive signs in his life, he had a new job and was planning to get married, he regularly faced trouble in the streets.
Everywhere I go, it seems that someone always wants to challenge me to a fight, he said.
On the night of June 25th, 1989, little Warren Griffin, that is, Warren G., knocked on Verna's bedroom door. Two white men in suits had arrived and wanted to speak to her. They broke the news. Tyree was dead. Apparently, he'd fought with a gang contingency and, in the scuffle, fatally hit his head on the concrete. He never regained consciousness.
I guess they were fighting and they fell, Dre said. All of them fell and my brother was at the bottom.
Dre received word at a truck stop during the NWA tour. He fell to his knees and began crying. He immediately flew home from the tour to grieve, help his mother cope, and plan Tyree's send-off.
I thought that everyone in the world who knew Tyree attended the funeral, Griffin wrote.
She took care of Tyree's son Cedric while his mother was away in the Navy, and Dre promised to support them. Tyree had been Dre's best friend and biggest supporter, and he was profoundly affected by his death.
After my brother passed away, I had started boozing, he said.
In his 1999 song, The Message, Dre raps,
Sometimes I wish I just died with you,
voicing his frustration with God. Tyree's death seemed to have inspired a cynicism in Dre that spilled over into his music. Whereas his lyrics had previously been anti-drug and anti-gang, he took a sharp turn in the years after the death.
The one who puts the G in it
he raps on the same song. Who you think put me in it? Eventually, Dre returned and the tour continued. But more trouble soon emerged. Following a July show in Birmingham, Alabama, MC Ren was accused of raping and impregnating a 16-year-old girl named Sheila Davis on the group's tour bus. She did not file criminal charges, but sued Ren, who had just turned 20, along with Easy, Yella, and Dre. Cube was not named. The case was originally settled for $350,000, but the NWA members refused to pay. One of their lawyers, Louis Serkin, offered a sworn statement that the musicians didn't approve the settlement, prompting a circuit judge to levy fines of $16 million on the group. This decision was reversed, and the case was scheduled to be retried. But it was resolved definitively out of court in 1993, with the woman, now 20, telling the Tuscaloosa News she was very happy with the settlement, which was reportedly $2 million. For his part, Ren was never charged with or convicted of rape. Davis's lawyer, Gusty Yearout, told the Daily Beast in 2015 that the four NWA members were polite when he came out to L.A. to take their depositions. That is, with the exception of Easy. Easy-E was kind of a smartass during the deposition, Yearout said. He said things like, Ren would never rape anybody without wearing a prophylactic. The business of censorship. The rape allegation didn't make many headlines. But a few months later, the group found itself caught up in the rap controversy of the decade. On August 1, 1989, Priority Records president Brian Turner received a piece of mail at the company's offices, printed on Department of Justice stationery. A song recorded by the rap group NWA on their album entitled Straight Outta Compton encourages violence against and disrespect for the law enforcement officer, and has been brought to my attention. I understand your company recorded and distributed this album, and I am writing to share my thoughts and concerns with you. Advocating violence and assault is wrong, and we in the law enforcement community take exception to such action. Violent crime, a major problem in our country, reached an unprecedented high in 1988. 78 law enforcement officers were feloniously slain in the line of duty during 1988. Four more than in 1987. Law enforcement officers dedicate their lives to the protection of our citizens, and recordings such as the one from the NWA are both discouraging and degrading to these brave, dedicated officers. Music plays a significant role in society, and I wanted you to be aware of the FBI's position relative to this song and its message. I believe my views reflect the opinion of the entire law enforcement community. The letter was signed by FBI chief spokesman Milt Ulrich. Ulrich's message was strange. It didn't accuse the group of breaking the law. They weren't. And it didn't threaten any specific repercussions, which would have likely been unconstitutional. The letter didn't even mention any specific NWA songs, though it was clearly referencing Fuck the Police. The FBI, then as now, didn't traditionally weigh in on any art, much less rap lyrics. The First Amendment does a pretty good job of keeping government entities out of the cultural conversation, and it turns out Ulrich, though speaking on behalf of the FBI, hadn't even heard the song. He'd only read the lyrics. If the letter was intended to make NWA nervous, the effort was only partially successful. I was scared. You kidding? It was the FBI. I'm just a kid from Canada. What do I know? Priority's Brian Turner told the Los Angeles Times. When the controversy broke, he'd just returned from the Soviet Union, where he was putting together a distribution deal for the label. I showed it to some lawyers. They said they, the FBI, couldn't do anything. That made me feel better. Ice Cube apparently took the news a little more lightly. Oh, I didn't know they, the FBI, were buying our records too, he said. The group kept the letter under their hat for a bit, and it didn't make big news until October,
when Phyllis Pollack, who began as a Ruthless Records publicist that year, and Dave Marsh, her partner in an anti-censorship organization group called Music in Action,